It is Thursday, March 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, North and South Korea set a date for their bilateral summit. Malala Yousafzai makes a dramatic return to her native Pakistan.
You know, the moment she started her speech, she got emotional and she broke down into tears.
And a happiness class attracts a record attendance at an Ivy League university. It's all ahead. Leaders of North and South Korea will meet for a summit April 27th at the South Peace House in the Truce Village of Panmunjom. It's the first meeting of this kind since 2007 and only the third since the 1953 armistice that ended the fighting in the Korean War that year. The announcement Thursday followed a surprise unofficial visit to Beijing by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, his first foreign travel since assuming power in 2011. Mr. Xi briefed President Donald Trump about the talks in which Mr. Kim pledged to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Wednesday, Mr. Trump tweeted he thought there was a good chance the North Korean leader would do what is right for his people and for humanity. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders suggested things are going in the right direction.
We're going to be cautiously optimistic, but we feel like things are moving in the right direction and that the meeting yesterday was a good indication that the maximum pressure campaign has been working. And we're going to continue moving forward in this process in hopes for a meeting down the road.
That meeting would be between Mr. Trump and Kim Jong-un. But despite growing hope for denuclearization, satellite imagery in recent weeks has revealed continuing activity at the North's Yongbyon Nuclear Research Center. Allison Puccioni, a consultant and affiliate with the Stanford University Center for International Security and Cooperation, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the North continues to produce weapons-grade plutonium.
There is no doubt that North Korea has been operating their 5-megawatt reactor for quite some time intermittently. And we know that the 5-megawatt reactor has been operational. We also know that it has been operating for weapons-grade plutonium. This has been the agenda, you know, for North Korea to build nuclear weapons-grade material for their arsenal. It has been happening for quite some time. This isn't necessarily new activity at the 5-megawatt reactor.
Is this malign activity? Is it directed toward nuclear weapons or is it simply for electrical needs?
The 5-megawatt reactor is not purposed for creating electricity. The 5-megawatt reactor is purposed for creating weapons-grade plutonium.
There are some various reports that indicate increasing activity or decreasing activity. What is your view?
The 5-megawatt reactor has been intermittently active for years. So this is not increasing or decreasing. It's my opinion that it's the same amount of activity that we've seen throughout 2017. And frankly, since the 5-megawatt reactor was more or less restarted for weapons production in 2013.
So as far as you know, the nuclear program continues relatively apace as it has in the past.
The 5-megawatt reactor is purposed for weapons-grade plutonium production, and that activity has continued apace. The second reactor, the one that North Korea broke ground construction on in 2010, has been under construction and inactive since 2010. So that is the experimental light water reactor. That reactor has been, at least ostensibly, purposed for electricity production.
RAND Corporation's senior international defense researcher Bruce Bennett tells Victor Beatty there is a view that Kim Jong-un will use his nuclear program as a bargaining tool to extract concessions from South Korea and the U.S.
I've talked with a number of very senior defectors who argue that in 1990, Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, was taking over responsibility for the nuclear program. And he ordered that action be taken to disclose Yongbyon to the Americans, but on the other hand, that 5 different alternative sites be set up to support the nuclear program, hoping that the Americans would focus in on Yongbyon and not pay attention to these other locations, which they could then operate covertly. I suspect that his son may be doing something similar right now. I think he's preparing for the summits, hoping to divert our attention, hoping to add new capabilities and be able to sustain them because they're covert, even after he's making the initial parts of an agreement, that we just don't ask for them to shut down location X or location Y. And so he continues operating them even after an agreement.
Verification is going to be very difficult under any agreement, won't it?
The key there is we've got to be able to have challenge inspections. And to go with that, we have to know where to look. We've got to be trying to get defectors from North Korea, from people out of the nuclear program who we encourage to leave North Korea and provide us at least cues on where to go look to find these things and then pursue challenge inspections.
Bruce Bennett said the White House correctly remains cautious about a breakthrough on the nuclear issue, insisting on keeping up the maximum pressure campaign. He said key to that will be China and what Chinese leader Xi Jinping may have promised the North Korean leader. Meanwhile, Japan is reportedly in talks with North Korea about another bilateral summit. Tokyo said it is in touch with Pyongyang, but declined to provide specifics. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, this is one of those happy days. We're not going to talk politics. We're not going to talk economics. We're not going to talk foreign international relations. We're going to talk baseball because today, as you probably know, is opening day. Major League Baseball in the United States and in Canada. And lots of people, the hashtag, if you use the hashtag opening day on Twitter, for example, you get your Twitter feed gets this little sort of red, white, and blue bunting, kind of the old-fashioned type stuff. Lots and lots of people talking about it, very excited. I don't know that baseball holds the sort of central place it used to in American culture maybe 40, 50, 60 years ago, but clearly it matters to a lot of people. Here's one of my favorites I found, McNeil. The Cincinnati Reds have been eliminated from postseason consideration. They're a really bad team, so that's a fan obviously kind of already getting ready for disappointment. Lots of retweeted Peanuts cartoons as well. Charlie Brown, Lucy, Snoopy, all the rest of them playing baseball, having a good time. So people just having a fun time with it. So let's have social media have some fun.
All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Trump will host a Baltic summit marking the centennial of their independence. A British hospital says a former spy's daughter is no longer in critical condition after her poisoning. President Trump accuses Amazon of not paying taxes and putting retailers out of business. And Ankara criticizes the U.S. support of new Serious Future political party. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Have you been anxiously waiting to see new and more dazzling views of space that NASA says will be provided by the new Webb Space Telescope? Well, sorry to disappoint you, but the space agency says they must delay sending the more powerful replacement to the Hubble into space yet again. NASA announced that after reviewing an independent assessment of what still needs to be done to assure a successful mission for the state-of-the-art space observatory, the previously revised 2019 launch window must now be moved up to approximately May 2020. Over the years, the Webb project has been plagued with a number of problems and delays, including a 2011 close call of being canceled completely. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, China's Communist Party tightens its grip on media and message. Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai returned Thursday to her native Pakistan nearly 6 years after she was shot by Islamist militants in her northwestern home district of Swat for advocating female education. Malala was 14 and already an advocate for girls' education in October 2012 when masked gunmen intercepted her school van and shot her in the head. Ayaz Gul in Islamabad describes Malala's surprise homecoming.
People in Pakistan were unaware of this trip until 24 hours ago, and it is obvious that for security reasons, her visit and other activities were kept confidential by the authorities. But then she landed early in the morning on Thursday in Islamabad, and then shortly afterwards, she met Prime Minister Shahid Khaqan Abbasi, where a big event specially was organized to welcome her.
And she apparently also gave a speech.
Yes, that big gathering in the Prime Minister's office was basically, there were lawmakers, government officials, civil society activists, and young students, and that's where Malala spoke. And, you know, the moment she started her speech, she got emotional and she broke down into tears, because that's what every young person would do after returning to her native country for more than 5 years. And obviously, she left in very difficult circumstances. She was, you know, doctors were struggling to save her life. And then she was airlifted to Britain, where she underwent surgery and finally survived this Taliban attack. So after having gone through this difficult time and returning to her homeland and standing in front of her home audience, the moment she started her speech, she started crying, and then she said that she could not believe that she is finally standing back on her homeland, on home soil. And, you know, she was really thankful to the government. And then, obviously, as we know, that globally she has been campaigning for female education to empower women. And that's what she used the occasion for, and emphasized the need for the government and activists in Pakistan to do more for promoting female education that she has been championing from a very young age.
Well, she certainly must be internationally one of the most famous, if not the most famous, Pakistani.
Well, that's what even the Prime Minister of this country today in his speech after he spoke, you know, he also addressed the gathering, and that's where he also acknowledged that, in fact, Malala Yousafzai is the most prominent citizen in the history of Pakistan. So that's the acknowledgement he gave. And that's true, that maybe 5 years ago, things were different. There were Islamist fundamentalists, you know, who were trying to portray this Taliban attack on Malala in her native Swat district as something that, you know, according to them, was state managed by Western powers who were trying to malign the Muslim Pakistan. But today, we saw a different situation, a different mood. She received really a warm welcome. On social media, there were tweets welcoming her from across the society. And the way this event was organized, and it was nationally televised, and her emotional speech really left behind a serious impression that maybe those who were critical of Malala's campaign for female education, maybe they will rethink what they were saying maybe a few years ago, because that young girl has brought a huge honor and name for this country, which has been under criticism for years for not doing enough for women, for minorities, religious minorities, particularly Christian and Hindus. And that's what Pakistan has been known internationally for, all these bad things. But after so many years now, today was a day when this young girl of 20 years age was standing right in the heart of the capital and addressing her audience.
Ayaz Gul reporting from Islamabad. China's Communist Party leadership is working to assert its control over state broadcasters and wants to regulate all types of media, including films, television programs, and books. The party approved the creation of what is called the Voice of China, a proposed merger of three top broadcasters, China Central Television, China Radio International, and China National Radio, into one entity. VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide speaks with me about this new organization.
Well, the thing that analysts are telling us is that this is about messaging. It's about getting Xi Jinping's vision clearly communicated to the rest of the world. And it's about tightening the party's control over these entities and over media. Now, we know that in China that media is already tightly controlled. Journalists are routinely told what to write about and what not to write about. And if they do break those guidelines, they face the penalties for it. But this is a crucial time, the Communist Party feels, because they have a very ambitious agenda that Xi Jinping has laid out for the next 30 years. And he has now received this mandate to continue to be China's president for as long as he wishes. So the thinking that analysts that we're talking to have shared with us is that what this is trying to do is to make sure that his message gets out and nothing else.
Well, one of the changes includes the dissolution of the State Administration of Press, Publication, Radio, Film, and Television, which has been, you know, very well known for a long time because it also oversees the amounts of, say, foreign films coming into China, which I know was an area of a big dispute for a while. So the fact that that's gone as well is kind of significant.
That's true. But what we're hearing, though, at this point is that the radio and television portion of that huge, long acronym, that huge, long name of a government body is going to be one portion. But the film portion, industry sources are saying that that may actually become a separate entity. It's still in the process of finding out actually how this is all going to develop. Because, you know, if you think about it, the movie industry is huge. And that's a big sector to deal with on its own. And it's a huge, you know, billions of dollars are coming in each year for the movies that are made and the kinds of money that is involved in that.
And China is such a huge growing market for Hollywood.
That's true. And at this point, I mean, last year we were, almost to the point that we're neck and neck with Hollywood, right? The amount of movie sales and ticket sales. And there's a lot of discrepancies about that and, you know, maybe fake and inflated ticket sales. But, you know, China is a huge movie market. And, you know, gradually more and more films are being let in the country. Still not as much as I think some production houses would like. But, yeah, we're seeing joint ventures a lot more. But the thing is, though, that regardless of whether it's the film industry or whether it's television or radio, this is still all coming closer under the party's control and under its thumbs. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out going forward. Some of the analysts that we talked to were mentioning that, you know, they don't think that this is something that the middle class or intellectuals in China are necessarily going to welcome. China's has the largest middle class in the world, and more people are traveling overseas. They're being exposed to things outside this great net of censorship that exists in China, and they're seeing different things, and there are different views and perceptions of things. One of the interesting things that, you know, analysts we were speaking with when we were working on this story had said to us was, you know, they were talking about how China really is a diverse place. It's an amazingly diverse, and there's different populations and huge, you know, cities and smaller cities and provinces, each with their own character. And to kind of say that, you know, China is one voice, it only has one voice and that there's no diversity, really kind of short sells the strengths of this country.
VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world, and you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. The pursuit of happiness is among the unalienable rights listed in the U.S. Declaration of Independence. Well, a record 1,200 students are attending a class that teaches students how to be happier at prestigious Yale University in Connecticut. VOA's Lotissa Hoch reports.
There are no empty seats in Yale's enormous concert hall where students listen to psychology professor Lori Santos.
Psychology and the Good Life is a class that really looks at what science says about how you can live a life that flourishes more, that makes you a little bit happier. We first deal with some of the misconceptions about what makes you happy.
We've all heard that money and riches won't make us happy. But scientific research finds that people still strive for certain achievements, thinking that they will make them happy, only to find out that they don't.
One of the main misconceptions is that to become happy, we have to change something. Like, we have to change something about our life. We have to get a better job, we have to get a bigger salary or a bigger house. And what the research suggests is that those life circumstances have a really tiny effect on our happiness.
Scientists estimate that improved life circumstances account for about 10% of happiness.
In fact, research suggests that spending time with other people, talking to other people, making these social connections is necessary for being a really happy person.
Spending time with family and friends is crucial, as is putting time aside for leisure. Santos says growing pressures to perform at school and work have created misconception in many people's mind about what is important for their well-being. Science is there to help them recognize what they really need. Some Yale students are heeding the advice.
I try not to stress out as much about grades. I try not to stress out about the next steps and jobs and things like that. I really try to focus on the present moment and the people around me.
I think now when I'm in a rush, my initial reaction isn't anymore to like try to run to whatever's stressing me. It's kind of take a half second, orient myself, and then move forward.
Homework assignments for the class include showing more gratitude, performing acts of kindness, and strengthening social connections. Due to overwhelming demand, the course is now being offered online and free to the public through Coursera.org. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government, through the ASEAN-U.S. Progress Partnership, continues to support ASEAN efforts to implement the ASEAN Convention on Trafficking in Persons, known as ACTIP, and its ASEAN Plan of Action. In collaboration with the ASEAN Secretariat and ASEAN's Commission on the Promotion and Protection of the Rights of Women and Children, or ACWC, Progress is supporting the development and drafting of regional guidelines and procedures to address the needs of TIP victims. Ahead of the 16th ACWC meeting in Jakarta, Progress, in collaboration with the WCD Handa Center of Stanford University, arranged for all ACWC representatives to come together for the third and final review of the guidelines ahead of their official endorsement during their upcoming meeting. The final draft has also been shared for comments and feedback with other relevant ASEAN bodies, the 9 sectoral body contributors to the Bohol Work Plan, and their feedback and inputs will also be incorporated into the final draft for endorsement. Once endorsed by the ACWC, the guidelines will provide ASEAN member states with a common approach through which to implement commitments under the ACTIP, presenting a set of agreed-upon regional multisectoral guidelines and procedures that reflect national, regional, and international commitments across 6 areas: victim definition and identification, victim protection and support, special measures for victim witnesses, special and additional measures for child victims, access to remedies, and return, recovery, and reintegration. The U.S. is proud to work with ASEAN and its international partners to help protect the peoples of the Asia-Pacific region from a terrible and age-old scourge of humanity, human trafficking.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. for a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.